Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we're going to talk about race and racism in an area we don't often mention, in academic publishing. We're talking about it now because of a couple of incidents that happened about a week ago at an annual conference for classicists in San Diego. During a panel, Black American scholar Daniel Padilla Peralta challenged something about the idea of Western civilization. Another panel speaker, Mary Frances Williams, seemed to take offense, and during the course of a back and forth, she said that he only got his job because he was Black. A day before, two other scholars of color attending the conference said they were stopped by and questioned by hotel security for no reason. The two incidents are just small skirmishes in a larger conversation about lack of diversity in academia, and more specifically, academic journals. Academic journals play an essential role in our understanding of the world, even if indirectly, because most people don't read them. But with millions of articles submitted to about 30,000 journals every year, the industry only has the bandwidth to reward the most privileged of researchers and universities, who are, after all, mostly white and arguably represent a relatively narrow view of the world. And so while research should help defeat ill-conceived notions about race, critics say in many cases academic publishing can wind up reinforcing racist ideas. Joining me for this conversation about the lack of diversity in academic publishing and its impact are two scholars who are leading this conversation from their respective places. Dr. Alex Lichtenstein, editor of the AHR, the American Historical Review, one of the premier history journals. He wrote a piece last year called Decolonizing the AHR after his journal published a book review widely considered racially tone-deaf. And also with us is Dr. Cristobal Salinas from Florida Atlantic University, professor and managing editor for the National Conference on Race and Ethnicity in American Higher Education. So Dr. Lichtenstein and Dr. Salinas, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian. This is Alex.
Thanks, Brian.
Dr. Lichtenstein, can you tell us about the incident that inspired your letter and how that prompted you to begin dealing with race directly at your particular academic journal?
Well, it's complicated, but the short version is we ran a book review of, you know, we run 800 book reviews a year. We ran a book review of a new book on school integration, the history of school integration. And it was written by someone who, in our database, appeared as an ordinary scholar who had published some reputable books on this issue. But what we missed, or what the journal editorial team missed at the time, was that the guy who wrote this review, Raymond Walters, had morphed into, not to put too fine a point on it, a white supremacist. Now, then, the review itself contained what I would call dog whistles or code words, such as sociobiology. Then a number of, and we have a letters column, a number of scholars wrote into us saying, how could you publish this review? We concluded that they were right. We repudiated, though didn't retract, repudiated the review, wrote a number of editorials, but then realized that we had some work to do in terms of investigating the history and the future of our own editorial practices in order to make the journal more inclusive, more diverse, and more open to the kind of new scholarship that is emanating from groups all around the country.
Dr. Salinas, if there's a lack of diversity in the staff of academic journals and in the citations and in university faculty, how deep is the issue?
So, Brian, again, thank you for the invitation, but I cannot enter the conversation without speaking about my own experiences of privilege and oppression as a Latino and Mexican, because in these academic spaces, we talk about how it's inclusive, right? But oftentimes, this academic space becomes very exclusive among ourselves. And I can think about my own experiences of because of my accent, my skin color, and being Mexican, how people engage with me in those spaces, right? But also, it becomes a political game, and it is a, and research has never been neutral, and it's also a political act when we publish and where we publish. So this is nothing new. This is something that scholars of color and also women of color been writing about for years. But it takes a while for someone to pick this up and say, we need to focus more on this. But again, we need more research on the lived experiences of students of color, faculty of color, and scholars that speak to the oppression and injustice that exists within our communities.
One particular issue that I read about that comes from public health researchers and other science researchers who want to study a specific issue in a particular racial or ethnic group, they sometimes don't get published or don't get the funding because the journals believe those sample sizes are too small when they're looking at particular groups in the population. Is that an issue, Dr. Salinas, that you're familiar with?
Well, you know, I think about the as a founding editor of the Journal Committee to Social Change on Race and Race and Ethnicity, published by the National Conference on Race and Ethnicity. So it's a new journal, open access, again, because when we think about journals, who has access to them? It's usually only academics, those that have access to a university library. So we interviewed survey of members of that conference, and all of them said, especially those that publish academics, that they struggle publishing their research because a lot of these journals do not publish work on race and ethnicity. So they continue to be rejected, not necessarily about the number, how many they interviewed, but most, the conversation goes back to, it is because it's on race and ethnicity, not about the numbers that they have access to in the data collection.
Right. So before we go back to Dr. Lichtenstein, you're talking about the need for academic journals, including one open source one that you're involved with, dedicated to race and ethnic studies, I think particularly in your field of higher education, right?
Yes, correct. Higher education.
And so, Dr. Lichtenstein, you... we'll talk about how your journal is newly engaged in this issue over the last year since you published Decolonizing AHR.
Yeah, well, I mean, I should say, first of all, it's newly engaged in some areas, and in others it's not, in that this has been the practice for a long time. This is a journal that publishes all history, all time periods, all areas. So there's always been articles on race and ethnicity. But I use the term decolonizing very deliberately and provocatively to say this isn't just a question of inclusion, but I think as Dr. Salinas is suggesting that by being more inclusive, you also have to change the nature of the conversation, right? You have to change the shape of the space in which this conversation is occurring rather than saying to excluded populations, come join us, but on our existing terms. Mm-hmm. No, you have to meet them halfway and say, and we are also going to change the nature of our review process, of what is considered scholarship, of our reputation as being a gatekeeper rather than a place in which scholarship is going to be nurtured and brought forward into a larger conversation. So it's not just changing who publishes in the journal. There's a lot of work to be done on that. It's not just changing what is published in the journal. I think we've done okay on that in the past. But it's really changing the idea of what is scholarship as it appears in a scholarly journal. And the steps I'm taking are efforts to not explode that, but to throw it into question and open it up to new voices.
And listeners, I don't know if we have anybody out there right now who has published or worked for any academic journals, but if you have a thought or a question about this area, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, or a story to tell, 212-433-9692. Dr. Lichtenstein, to follow up on what you were just saying, is it like people tend to react, let's say well-meaning people who are mostly white in academia, react when blatant racism is in front of their eyes, but not as many see a kind of colorblind racism, if you want to call it that, the structural and invisible ways that lack of diversity shapes research outcomes and conclusions?
Yeah. I mean, in the case of the American Historical Review, I'm not sure if it's research outcomes and conclusions, but just a sense when I go to the national conference, that the AHR is a space that is, you know, reserved for the privileged. And that can mean the privileged by rank, the privileged by institution, and of course the privileged by race, ethnicity, class, gender, and sexuality, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, and that's a reputation that is rooted in a very real history of exclusion going back to the foundations of the historical profession for decades and decades. It was all white, all male, all Protestant, I would add. Jews had to break into it. But it's the profession itself has changed very dramatically over the past 20, 25 years, become much more equitable in terms of gender, at least in terms of faculty, getting better on race and ethnicity and sexuality. But I'm not always convinced that that professional demographic change is sufficiently reflected in the pages of the journal. And so the goal is to simply try and invite new voices in so that more and more people who are coming into the profession can say, well, actually, this is a space for us. This is an inviting space for us. And that requires breaking down barriers of perception on the side of those who feel excluded. And yes, it requires breaking down the sort of reflexive white liberal move, which is to say, yes, but what about standards? And that's the phrase I hate and try to avoid at all costs.
Dr. Salinas, do you want to just pick up on that?
Yeah, so I think about a lot of things, right? And one of those things that scholars have argued in higher education, again, how the graduate experience has been socialized by white faculty members, advisors, and staff, right? And they're nominating this socialization process in education. But also, Sandra Stiers stated that it's not only about who is white based on identity and skin color, but it's also about whiteness and how in the how whiteness is perpetuated and maintained through networks and relationships of power and privilege within across societies and in this conversation within publishing, right? So a lot of editors have the power, right? Because and who are in these editorial boards are mostly white people. Are critical and conscious and are working strategically to create opportunities to showcase the diverse perspectives of academics. But also decolonizing requires a critical consciousness about realities of oppression and in social inequalities for minority people.
What do you think, Dr. Salinas, the real world effects of everything the two of you have been talking about here so far are? A lot of listeners could be hearing this and thinking, well, okay, this is all about things that take place in, you know, the rarefied air of academic journals. Does who in the rest of the world gets hurt by this?
Yeah. So I think that's an excellent question. One of the things that I have to acknowledge again is my privilege. Now that I am a faculty with a PhD, and when I write, in a sense, I'm making sense of the lived experiences of people, right? But I see my job as an academic scholar to tell the story of those unheard voices, those that have been marginalized historically and continue to be marginalized, right? So I'm gonna bring it up to the perspective of a scholarship. 74% of the scholarship across the world, not only in the United States, but across the world, is published in English, right? So when we think about how is my research making an impact to my community, in my case, a Spanish-speaking community, when I think about my parents not being able to understand what I write about. So what I attempt to do in my scholarship is to write in Spanish, right? Because we need to publish in various languages as a form of liberation and to provide context and document the stories in history for our non-English speakers communities as well. Because if you get a PhD or a doctorate degree from a Spanish-speaking, for most Spanish-speaking countries and some other countries outside of the United States, in order to earn your doctoral degree, you have to publish 3 peer-reviewed manuscripts, and on top of that, of writing your dissertation in your native language. So I think that challenge is how do we also remove ourselves from, or how do we create scholarship for our community? And also creating more academic journals with open access to, so these people have access to what we're writing in their language.
So Dr. Lichtenstein, you said before that it's not just the diversity that needs to change, it's the scholarship itself. Do you think research methods in the social sciences or anything else that results in the publication of what looks like scientific studies are dealing with a lot of bias and research methods themselves need to change?
Well, that's a tough one from the perspective of a historian. So, I mean, one could certainly say that, yes, you need to listen to other voices. So you need to do a lot of oral history if you're doing contemporary history, or if you're reading colonial archives, you need to read them against the grain to get the perspective of the subaltern. But the profession has been talking about this for a long time. So I don't think that's the big issue. I mean, what Dr. Salinas was saying to your last question is really key. I mean, you began by saying, well, you know, these have limited readership. And I'll grant you, I mean, look, I edit an academic journal. As academic journals go, it has a pretty wide ambit. I think 13,000 people get it. It's widely read, blah, blah, blah. But still, it's ring-fenced within a rarefied, privileged world of academia. And those are the people who are going to read and speak about what's in there. That said, the public face of the AHR puts the imprimatur on certain kinds of research, certain topics, certain themes, certain questions, and says with a big, bold sign, this is what counts as historical scholarship today. And that can be changed. And by changing that, it then eventually will filter down, and it gives the historical profession, this is a professional journal, I have no shame in that, a different kind of face and a different kind of voice. And I should add, I mean, we're the Journal of the American Historical Association, which is the professional association, and the AHA is also attempting to rethink what the nature of the organization is in terms of diversity, inclusion, equity, beyond just the university faculty room or the library or the privileged access to the journal, but what it means to be a historian. Sometimes that shifts research techniques, but we're not a social science in the same way that sociology mm-hmm. might be.
And there we have to leave it because we're out of time. Dr. Alex Lichtenstein is the editor of the American Historical Review, and Dr. Cristobal Salinas from Florida Atlantic University is a professor and the managing editor of the National Conference on Race and Ethnicity in American Higher Education. Thank you both so much for engaging in this conversation.
Thank you.